Our reading this morning is from Matthew chapter 1. I don't have all of Matthew chapter 1 in the bulletin because there's not room for it. And it's a difficult chapter because it's one of those genealogies that Tom talked about. So I'm going to read a part of it, and most of it is in your bulletin, the part that I'm going to read. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob, Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. And it goes on. And I'm going to skip down to verse 16. And there's a different Jacob there. Jacob, the father of Joseph, a different Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. Thus, there were 14 generations in all, from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah. That's the reading today. It is December the 1st. There was frost out this morning. Thanksgiving has come and gone. I hope yours was as good as ours. I hope you had lots of food and time with family and football and all of the things, whatever your Thanksgiving tradition includes. And now, it's okay to turn on the Christmas music and put up the tree. It's officially time. And good job, Bob. And this is my annual reminder. And if you know me, you know this is coming. And as long as I have breath, this is going to come around the first part of December. My annual reminder that it's okay for Christians to celebrate Christmas. Now, it may seem silly that we have to say that, but I've lived through a time, and many of you have as well, where it was kind of taboo for Christians to say, well, we don't celebrate Christmas because we don't know when Jesus was born. And we could sing Christmas carols as long as it wasn't in December. And that's the truth. And it's kind of a sad truth. But well-meaning people kind of got misguided. And so they wouldn't celebrate Christmas. We would only talk about the birth of Jesus other times of the year. But as a wise man once told me, if the rest of the world is at least open to the idea that Jesus came at this time of year, then why shouldn't we all talk about it as well? And so it is okay for us to talk about and celebrate Christmas. It's part of the rhythm of life. You know, the Jews had their festivals that God gave them. He had annual reminders of things to remember and celebrate. They recalled the story of the Passover every year so they wouldn't forget. And I think we need to retell the story of the birth of Jesus every year as well so we don't forget. All four of the Gospels tell us the story of the life of Jesus, and they all begin in different ways. Luke begins with that wonderful birth narrative. It talks about the shepherds and the baby in the manger that we prayed about this morning. It's a beautiful story. Mark's Gospel was very different. He begins right away with the baptism, the temptation, and the ministry of Jesus. It's an action-packed Gospel. It's always in a hurry and a rush. He doesn't waste time talking about the birth. He knows that others are covering that. John takes us back with this cosmic view of everything, the pre-creation view of Jesus in eternity past with God the Father. Jesus the Creator doesn't talk about the birth narrative. But Matthew starts with a genealogy of Jesus. Now, as Tom said, Luke starts with a genealogy as well, and they look very different. It might be confusing to you, but they're written for different purposes. Luke writes his, again, as Mary's genealogy, and he does it in a more traditional way, only citing the men in the generations, fathers begetting sons, begetting sons, begetting sons, on down the line. But Matthew's genealogy is different. It wouldn't all fit in the bulletin, as I said. There are names, names, and more names. 42 generations of names. And there's some difficult names in there, which is another reason I'm not going to try to read the whole thing. And if you look at it from first glance, these genealogies can be challenging. They look like a phone book, if you remember what those are, at first glance. But as Tom said, they're there for a purpose. Every name has a story. As Peter says, there are stories, biblical history, as we walk through these names. Some of these names everyone recognizes. People know Solomon and David and Joseph. And some names only serious Bible students would recognize. But each of these names had an important place in the history of the Bible, in the history of Jesus, and in our history. Each one had their place, from the greatest king to the lowliest commoner. They all had a place, and all of their names are recorded for us. And it is impressive to me that there are 42 generations recorded for us. My family tree, I don't know about yours, but my family tree is a lot harder to trace. We can go back a few generations, a couple hundred years, and then it gets really murky. You can look at, I've looked at Ancestry.com and some of those websites, and it'll take you to some forks in the road, and we'll say it could be this one or it could be this one, and I don't know. And I don't have anybody older now to look to say, which one is it? People didn't keep really good records. People moved around a lot. And truthfully, there were probably some really shady characters in my family tree that a lot of my ancestors along the way would just as soon have forgotten about. I know some of those stories were true in recent generations. I'm sure they were in past generations. That's not uncommon. History tells us that King Herod was embarrassed about his family tree. When he became king, one of his first official acts was to take the ancestral records of his family tree and he burned them because he was embarrassed by some of the people, the shady characters in his past. And he didn't stop there. He rewrote a fictitious ancestry that was really glowing and flowery. He was really happy about it, but it was just all a piece of fiction. But our genealogies, while they would be nice for us to reflect back on, to look back at some of my ancestors that I never saw, for Jews, ancestry was something more significant. They all wanted to be able to trace their origin back to Father Abraham, the father of their faith. So Matthew does that. He traces the family tree of Jesus back 42 generations, all the way back to Abraham. And another difference about Luke's genealogy, he goes all the way back to Adam. Talk about some family records. So this genealogy of Jesus that we have in Matthew chapter 1 takes us back generation to generation, all the way back to Abraham. And Abraham had a son named Isaac. And just three names into the genealogy, we come to a person with a sketchy past, Jacob. Jacob, even his name meant supplanter, or one who circumvents, who takes the place of, a cheater basically, a sooner if you're from Oklahoma. Okay, there you go, good job. Making sure you're still listening. Because when he was born, his twin brother came out first, but Jacob had a grip on Esau's ankle, and they named him Jacob, the supplanter. His brother Esau was entitled to the birthright, but Jacob, with the help of his mother, would deceive Isaac into blessing him and giving him the family blessing. Jacob went on to be renamed Israel, and you know the story. He had sons of his own. Judah was the oldest. Each of those sons became a tribe. Judah was the oldest of them, and he is named in this family tree. And then after Judah, his sons are listed. But this is where an interesting thing happens in Matthew's genealogy. He shifts from the very traditional Jewish genealogy of listing only the men, and he begins to include the women. And the first woman he includes in the genealogy is Tamar. Tamar was Judah's daughter-in-law. And if you know your Bible stories, this is one of those stories that we don't tell our kids because it's a little salacious. But Tamar, she wasn't Jewish. She was a Canaanite. She married Judah's son. And Genesis 38 tells us that after Judah's son died, she would have been entitled to a Levirate marriage, which means she would have been one of the sons. The other sons, her brothers-in-law, would have taken her as a wife. And if they didn't, then Judah should have. None of them fulfilled their Levirate vow. And so in Genesis 38, it tells us the story of her posing as a prostitute to seduce her father-in-law, Judah, so she can bear his son. This ancestry, this genealogy and lineage of Jesus begins really early on with a scandalous story. And it's not the only one. A few generations later, we see regular people, what we would say, Aminadab, who was the father-in-law of Aaron. Okay, Aaron was somebody, a prominent figure. Aaron had a son named Nashon, and after him came after him. Nashon is not a real as well a known figure, but he wasn't a king, but he was a leader in the tribe of Judah. He was a prominent figure in the tribe's history. He was one of those who was included in the census of people who were more than 20 years of age when the spies returned from the promised land. So he would have died in the wilderness. Again, another name and a whole other set of stories that go along with this lineage of Jesus. And then come more women. It mentions Nashon's grandson, Boaz. He is there along with his mother, Rahab. And you remember Rahab from the story of Jericho. Rahab was a prostitute. She hid the spies and she helped them escape when the men of Jericho were trying to find them. Rahab was not only a prostitute, she was a Canaanite. So you've got another non-Jewish woman in this lineage of Jesus. And Boaz, Rahab had a son named Boaz. And then Boaz married Ruth, who was not Jewish, but she was a Moabite woman. The Moabites were the descendants of the incestuous relationship between Lot and one of his daughters. More scandal, more gross details, if you will. There's a story here of Ruth. It's a beautiful story. Another story that we could go back and spend time on. A beautiful story of God working through the tragedies of life, famine and death, and across foreign borders and racial lines. And all of it is done to continue the lineage of the Messiah, Jesus. Rahab had a son named Boaz, a godly man. Boaz married Ruth, and they had a son named Obed, who had a son named Jesse. And Jesse had a whole bunch of sons, and the only one that we really remember his name is the youngest one, the runt, David. King David. Now, this particular part of the family tree of Jesus is really important. Just as important as being able to trace back to Abraham, it's important that Matthew wanted us to know that Jesus came from the line of David. It's critical because Old Testament prophecy said that the Messiah was going to come from the house of David. And so when the religious leaders of Jesus' day would have heard the claims that he was making to be the Son of Man, the Son of God, when people ask him, "Are you the Messiah?" and he would say, "I am," one of the first places they would have gone to look to disqualify him was the family records. And if they could go back and prove that he was not from the house of David, from the lineage of David, it would have eliminated him, excluded him. But of course, they went back and they looked, and he was from the line of David. Matthew emphasized that point. He was very clear about it. So Matthew also breaks this lineage down into three sets of 14 generations. Now, a lot of scholars think that he did this to highlight the fact that Jesus came from the house of David. You see, in the Hebrew language, every letter is assigned a number. And different letters have different letters in the alphabet have different numbers. Consonants only. In David's name, the consonants are what we would call D, V, and D. They would be assigned the value 4, 6, and 4, which is 14. So in a sense, Matthew is telling everybody, and a lot of scholars think he is doing this, with David's name being the number 14, he's breaking it into three sets of 14 generations while giving us this lineage of Jesus. In the process, he is saying, "David, David, David," emphasizing the point that Jesus is in fact the Messiah who did come from the house of David. Now, again, David is a name we all recognize. And then comes more. We see his son Solomon, a name everybody knows. But Matthew goes a step further. He could have just said David and then Solomon and then Jeroboam. But he pauses in here and he says David and then Solomon. And he inserts this phrase, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. He could have just said Bathsheba. But that was that's an unnecessary detail. But to make sure we did not miss the point, he said Solomon, who was the wife of Uriah the Hittite, the one that David killed after the adulterous relationship with Bathsheba. Matthew is calling attention to it. It has no bearing on the lineage, but it's there for a reason. All of these names are included there for a reason. And from wise King Solomon, we see a succession of kings now. We've had King David, we've had Solomon, then comes Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, and on down the list. And that's all the names I'm going to try to pronounce. Some of them were completely given over to the pagan gods of the countries they were supposed to have driven out of the land. Here's an example. King Ahaz, and you've heard Wayne teach on these. They went through the succession of roller coaster from a good king to an evil king and back and forth. King Ahaz worshiped the Baals, and he was so far gone into pagan worship that he sacrificed his own sons in the fire. Scripture says this of him: he followed the detestable ways of the nations the Lord had driven out. It says essentially the same thing about his grandson, King Manasseh, and Manasseh's son, Amon. They were evil. But they're also all ancestors of Jesus. And they're included in this lineage. It's shocking, but it's true. And eventually things got so bad, God sent foreign armies in to conquer Israel and take them away into Babylon. But the bloodline of Jesus continued even in exile. And Matthew mentions the exile in this lineage. After the exile, we find a man named Zerubbabel who led the people back home. What an honor that must have been. And when they got there, he was charged with rebuilding the temple. He's an ancestor of Jesus. He was charged with rebuilding the very temple that Jesus would chase the money changers out of later on. Zerubbabel's grandson, Eliakim, is in the genealogy. He wasn't a king, but he served kings as this righteous, high-profile administrator, a notable person. And so far, we've just basically seen names of people who were prominent in Jewish history, kings and nobles. Some of them were righteous and good people, and some just downright evil. Some of them were famous, and some of them were infamous. People with some history recorded about them. They were and still are either really well known or relatively well known. But then we come to some names that we know very little about. There are names in here that if they weren't included in the genealogy of Jesus in this family tree, we would have no record that they ever existed. History would not remember their names even if they weren't listed here. And it wasn't necessarily because they were way back in the family tree. You know, that's where our trees get kind of murky, is trying to go back very far. We know the name of Joseph's father was Jacob, but we know nothing else about him from the Bible, only that he was Jacob's father. And there are several others that are that way. We know nothing of their stories, but they had a story. So why does Matthew record the family tree in this way? And what is it that leads up to the birth of Jesus? And what does this teach us? Well, I've taken a few lessons from this week, and I want to share with you in the time that we have left. The first thing that I think of is that God uses broken people to accomplish his purposes. And you've heard this before. He uses broken people because that's all there are. We are all broken individuals. We all have a history and a past, some more public than others, but we all have a scandal of some sort. We've all fallen short and let God down. I often hear people say, man, my family is so dysfunctional. And when they're talking with me, and I tell them, they all are. They all are. Some of us just do a better job of hiding it. I promise you. I heard a funny one the other day. It said a guy was at his doctor's office, and he's answering all the questions about medical history. And the doctor says, does anyone in your family suffer from mental illness? And the guy thought for a minute. He says, no. He said, they all seem to enjoy it. That's my family. We're just as dysfunctional as anybody else's. We just do a good job of covering it up. And some of the people in this genealogy were way beyond dysfunctional. They were just flat out evil. And then there were some righteous people like David who made major mistakes in their lives. There were good kings who did well for most of their lives, and then they let their pride become their downfall. But we know that God was working through all of the people in this list to bring about the entrance of the baby Jesus to this world. Now, we know Jesus existed in eternity past, but he entered this world, Emmanuel, God with us in the flesh, through this process that God initiated that took 42 generations to take place. And I think that's why Matthew went out of his way to not only include, but to highlight the scandals in this ancestral record of Jesus. He wanted us to know that, yes, God works in all things, as he says in Romans 8:28, for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purposes. But some of those things that he works in are the lives of flawed, imperfect, and sometimes even evil people. Wayne mentioned this last week, God working in the life of Pharaoh to show his power and his majesty and his sovereignty over all the earth. God used an evil man like Pharaoh to do that. So that's my first lesson. God uses broken people to accomplish his purposes. But then I thought about, okay, what about this promise that God made that we read about in the call to worship, where God promised to place a descendant of David on the throne as long as the moon and sun endure. The moon and the sun are still out there. Psalm 89 says that there's going to be a descendant of David on the throne. Well, a skeptic would say, okay, where's your descendant of David sitting on the throne? Israel doesn't have a king. Israel has a prime minister who's got a warrant out for his arrest right now. It's a strange world. But we know the answer. The answer is Jesus. He's not just the king of Israel. He is king over all the earth. A few verses that tell us about that. In Revelation, a few. Chapter 1, verse 4 and 5. John opens this letter of Revelation that he's sharing to the seven churches in the province of Asia. Grace and peace to you from him who is and who was and who is to come, and from the seven spirits before his throne, and from Jesus Christ, who is the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead, and the ruler of the kings of the earth. A couple of chapters later, in chapter 3, Jesus says this, "To the one who is victorious, I will give the right to sit with me on my throne, just as I was victorious and sat down with my Father on his throne." And then in chapter 17, talking about things that were to come. "They will wage war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will triumph over them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings." Okay, and a skeptic might say, well, that's Revelation. Isn't that all future stuff? Well, not all completely, but if you want something a little bit different, go back to Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2. "Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and he sat down at the right hand of God on the throne." That's past tense. And he sat on that throne, and he is still on that throne. And like our call to worship from Psalm 89 said, God said, "I have sworn to David, my servant, I will establish your line forever and make your throne firm through all generations." He is still on that throne. "I will establish his line forever, that his line will continue forever. His throne will endure before me like the sun. It will be established forever like the moon and the faithful witness in the sky." God has fulfilled that promise. Jesus is on his throne. He is still Lord of lords and King of kings, and he has a plan for you in his kingdom. And you may say, like I think so many of people in Scripture said, "Who am I that God would use me?" We see that so many times. Well, the last point that I want to use in or mention in this lesson from the lineage of Jesus is that God works not just in the lives of the elite, the kings, but God works in the lives of common people who are not well known. As I've gone back and I've looked through these 42 generations of Jesus' life this last week, I've been thinking about the ones that we know little or nothing about. They were born, they worked, they married, they had children, and they died. They're not listed in Hebrews chapter 11, that great chapter of the Hall of Faith where the prominent people of our faith are listed. They just lived their lives and died. But can you imagine how their lives might have been changed had they known that they were in the lineage of the Messiah? What must that have done to their attitude? Everything they did, I think, would have taken on new meaning. To know that they are important in God's plan in life. To know that their life has meaning. And behind them, there are people who are not listed in Matthew chapter 1, but were crucial in the continuation of the ancestral lineage. Naomi is not mentioned in the Matthew lineage of Jesus. But without her, Ruth would never have met Boaz. There would have been no Obed, no Jesse, no David. But because of Naomi's godly life, her daughter-in-law Ruth said, "Where you go, I will go, and your people will be my people, and your God will be my God." And she ended up meeting Boaz, and she has the son with him, and the lineage continues. God worked in that story in all things, including famine and untimely deaths, because three other people who were not mentioned in Matthew chapter 1 are Naomi's husband and her two sons who died. But without their deaths, she would have never returned to her homeland. If people who were listed in Matthew chapter 1 had no idea about their significance in history, those who were another step removed surely would not have realized. But their lives were important. Harley sent me something early this morning that he didn't know I would use this morning, but it illustrates this point, I think, very well. If you put a basketball in my hands, it's worth maybe $20, whatever the basketball is worth, because I can shoot free throws and that's about it. But you put that same basketball in the hands of Michael Jordan and it's worth millions. If you put a golf club in my hands, it's worth even probably less than the golf club is worth because I would devalue it. My golf game is so bad. But if you put that same golf club in the hands of Tiger Woods, it's worth millions. It's the same for us. My life on this earth, on my own, is not worth much. Your life on your own, really, I mean, it's not to say you're not a valuable person, but really, it's not worth that much on your own. But in the hands of God, it is priceless. Just like the lives of all these common people in this genealogy. Unknown people who God had a plan and a purpose for. Just like He has a plan and a purpose for each of us. We don't have to have a knowledge of what He is doing for us and what He has planned to do in our lives. We just need to live our lives as followers of Jesus and share the good news everywhere we go. We love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbor as ourselves. Jesus Himself said that sums it all up. And in the process, He will use that obedience for His purposes. And if we know that, not just intellectually, but if we know that in our hearts, that He has a plan and a purpose for me, and I may never see the fruit of what He has planned for me, just like Ruth and Naomi never saw it. But if I have that knowledge, then it should change the way I look at life. I don't have to know what He is doing. I just need to know that He is doing something good and perfect because that's all He ever does. That should make us excited to face each new day. Just knowing that God works in all things and God works in all people, including you and me. Let's pray.